favorite scary movie. Have you checked the children?
It's all for you!
We have such sights to show you.
Oh, you're going on a boat.
Yeah, I'm about to go on a boat. It'll be fun. Yeah.
Like just like a little like bay cruise?
Or? I have no idea. I'm just going. We'll see. We'll see how it goes.
Okay, that sounds like fun though.
Yeah.
And then you'll get to take pictures. I love the water, so.
I'm really not a fan of water. It kind of freaks me out, but.
Really?
Yeah, I don't like it.
Oh, wow.
I don't like it the same way Jason doesn't like water.
Great way to tie it in. Right? Let's go ahead and get started.
All right, okay.
Welcome everyone to another episode of the Horrible People's Podcast. I am your host, Alex Webster. As always, I am joined by my wonderful co-host, Anthony Fuentes, who is, I recently discovered, terrified of water.
I am terrified. That actually wasn't a throwaway transition there. I legitimately just thought, like, oh, right, Jason hates water, too.
I had no idea you were afraid of water.
I don't like being submerged in water.
Really?
No, like even baths, I'm like, fuck baths. I'll take a shower.
Wow.
Yeah. Pools? Mm-mm.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And the ocean. I like looking at the ocean, though.
That's so interesting to me.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm like, I love swimming. I was on swim. My mom hated taking me to the beach because I would just disappear.
Oh, dude, the beach has water and sand. It's like the worst. And sun, just oppressive sun. It's the worst.
It's true. Now that I'm older, I'm not as big of a fan of the beach as I would like to be because I don't like sand. We all become Anakin. We hate sand. But I think that now, like, I do love water. Like, I've always loved water. I could swim before I could walk. Like,
interesting.
Yeah.
No, I can. I was a walker talker, and probably the first sentence was like, don't put me in there.
No, I love swimming. So that's very interesting. I'm learning something right along
right
with
after
you guys.
Years.
I know. After years. So funny. So today, just like Jason, we are talking about Friday the 13th Part 2.
Just like Jason, does Jason talk about Friday the 13th Part 2 regularly?
You know what? He's involved in the movie. Okay. I'm tying it in. It's early.
It's true. This is one of the few morning recordings.
But, fuck off. Anyway, so to continue on with our sequel theme of the month, we are talking about Friday the 13th Part 2. Surprisingly enjoyable.
Yeah, I was astonished by how much I really like this film.
Yeah.
Like, and I saw it twice before this one. I mean, I've seen it a bunch of times before, but I remembered I always watched it on like old shitty CRTs back in the day, and then I finally got to watch the, you know, projector and all the setup. It's a really well-filmed movie.
It's done really well. Yeah.
I was surprised. It's like not cheap.
Yeah, right up top, sober scale. When you were watching this movie?
The what?
How sober were you when you were watching this movie?
Oh, only mildly high.
Oh, okay.
I was pretty sober.
I was really high when I watched it.
Oh, I just had one cup of whiskey too, though.
Oh, okay.
But like a tiny cup, like, you know.
The tiny little, like a sipping,
like a Saturday night whiskey, yeah.
Okay, because for me, I watched it on Thursday, and I had just gotten paid.
Oh, yeah.
I had just gotten paid, so I went, and I had deposited my check. I got wings.
That sounds awesome.
And I came home, and, like, everything was great, and I blasted my air conditioner. I got really, really high, and I ate my wings, and I watched Friday the 13th.
That sounds like
two.
That's how you should be watching this film, everyone.
It was so good.
If you guys haven't seen Friday the 13th Part 2, you can pause, and then I would say normally watch Friday the 13th Part 1, but this starts with like a 13-minute fucking opening of Friday the 13th Part 1.
Honestly, everything you need to know about Friday the 13th Part 1 is addressed in Friday the 13th
Part 2. I think it's actually one of the longest intros ever, or prologues.
To the point where I thought, like, I was like, oh, because I've never seen Friday the 13th Part 2. I was just like, oh, Friday the 13th Part 2, kind of similar to Halloween 2, picks right back up.
Yeah.
And it follows the same characters, which is completely false.
It does it for like 3 minutes.
It does it for a good 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But nope.
Yeah.
But let's go ahead and get started. Huh? So our IMDb synopsis.
Yeah, let me get on that one. This is Mrs. Voorhees is dead and Camp Crystal Lake is shut down. but a camp next to the infamous place is stalked by an unknown assailant.
Ooh. Who could it be?
Everybody knows who it is, but they're just like, no. Right. Fucking child psychologist and everybody.
Who could it be?
Yeah. This was written by Ron Kurz and directed by Steve Miner, who was his directorial debut. It starred Adrian King, who was actually the star of the first film. When I said starring, just literally just 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Amy Steele and John Furry. Furry?
I think Furry's fine.
John Furry. Box office, it had a budget of $1.25 million. It released on April 30th in good old 1981, around the same time as Halloween 2.
Ah.
And it was also grossed just over $21 million, so pretty profitable.
Yeah, for sure.
Enough for 10 sequels.
Soon, and then like 4 remakes.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's within the oh, okay. realm. Yeah, it's all because they're waiting on the Friday the 13th movie. But the rights are all fucked up, which you can kind
of... Oh, so we don't have a 13th.
We don't have a 13th, right? That's supposed to be the next one, but, like, the rights are all... I didn't put it in this one, but, you know, the rights are screwy.
Yeah.
It's, like, worse than Child's Play series, like, for real.
Are we going to get into it?
Probably not here.
Well, yeah. Obviously not here, but, like...
At some point, for sure.
At some point, I think we should get into it.
At some point, there's going to be a divide behind the scenes. You'll definitely see that.
We'll learn the truth.
But if you're following us off from the first Friday 13th,
welcome
back. And Alex is going to give us what happened exactly after the success of said film.
Okay, so the success of Friday the 13th truly came as a...
it's morning.
The success of Friday the 13th truly came as a surprise to the filmmakers of the now iconic film.
Yes.
No one was expecting this film to succeed, and it surprised everyone.
It was named after a date.
Like, just because.
Yeah.
not so much that it made money. It was cheap enough, and that was an inevitability, but the sheer cultural impact of the film, along with its help in revitalizing the slasher genre, made the studio believe in the franchise potential of the name Friday the 13th.
Yeah, I mean, it really is actually a good name.
Yeah, like, oh, yeah. Of course.
The number 13, I was born on Friday the 13th, you know, I have an attachment to it.
Oh, yeah, because Mm-hmm. I mean, I was really close. My birthday's on a 14th.
Oh, you missed the cut. Uh-huh. Just barely.
Just barely. If I see, what sucks is, like, 15 is my favorite number.
Ah.
And then 13 would have been great because I would have had a Friday the 13th at some point in my life.
Yeah, but you're just stuck right in the middle.
I'm stuck right in the middle,
oh,
so.
Unfair.
I know, I'm cursed.
Like, that's actually how my life has just been for the mm-hmm. this whole
oh,
time.
Oh, yeah, the whole time. Not to mention, even more copycats were coming off of both Halloween and Friday the 13th success.
Yep.
So we see that a lot, especially in this time period.
Mm-hmm. This is early slasher evolution, where last week we covered, like, the commentary on all this mm-hmm. shit. So.
Well, and then we also get, like, My Bloody Valentine at this time period
as
well.
Oh, yeah, that's this year, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know... That's the only one that's really coming to mind. But...
Oh, I have a list coming at the end of this.
Oh,
don't
see,
worry.
Fantastic.
Yeah, you got it.
not to mention... I already said that. So
we're coming back.
Georgetown Productions had financed the first film and sold it to Paramount. This arrangement was ideal for Paramount, and they cut a deal with the company. If Georgetown Productions could deliver a film just as marketable as the first one, they would put it into theaters.
I love how Paramount's, like, so hands-off. They're mm-hmm. like, listen, you guys finance and do everything, and if we think it's cool, we'll buy it and put it out. How about that? And
about
they're
that?
Just like, we'll make the trash? Fuck you.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
instantly, offers were put out to the geniuses that made the first film so successful. Director Sean S. Cunningham, effects wizard Tom Savini, and writer Victor Miller.
Mm.
They all instantly turned Georgetown Productions' ass down.
Yeah, they did not want to be a part of this.
Which, you know. Their reasoning, however, did make sense. Most of the characters had died in the first one, including the killer, so there wasn't much to expand on in the universe.
Yeah, see, this is early in slasher sequel history where these rules are all becoming established.
Yeah, like, at this point, there's nothing really confirmed. Or
no.
There's no rules to follow.
There
They're
isn't.
Establishing said rules.
Exactly.
Which is what makes it so cool.
So that's why, like, the original team was actual filmmakers. So they're just like, no, we can't. If we're going to do a sequel, it has to have, like, a story and this. And they're just like, no. let's just have the fodder.
Initially, they wanted the film to be an anthology, but partner Phil Scuderi pitched the idea of Jason somehow surviving and coming back to avenge his slain mother.
Ooh. Good idea, Phil. Phil changed history right
Way
there.
Way to go, Phil. There was much skepticism for the remaining team, and after his departure, Tom Savini stated, "For Jason to be around today means what? He survived by living off of the crawfish on the side of the lake for 35 years. No one saw this kid walking around and growing up." Which,
that's a good point.
Good point.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Point, counterpoint.
Yeah.
With this shift in focus and lacking the creative heads of the last film, things didn't look great for the prospective sequel at this point. But alas, the Hollywood money machine rolled on, and production companies looked inward to get the franchise ball rolling.
Yeah, they wanted to make this money. They're like, dude, we have $1.2 million. That made 40.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just pump one out.
Let's just test it. What could happen? What's the worst that could happen?
We'll lose. They're not losing money. They know that for sure.
Yeah.
But now there's a new crew on the way. So director Steve Miner, who was an associate producer on the first film, signed on as director. He was chosen because he was trusted with a lot of the creative duties under Sean S. Cunningham, and he even managed to snag most of Cunningham's crew for his directorial debut. So people wanted to actually still be a part of this film. Ron Kurtz was brought on board as writer, as he gave the original film a polish, which is usually like a last minute kind of like overdo of the script to just make sure everything's kind of running. But he was uncredited in the first film due to rules at the Writers Guild of America. That would obviously not be the case for this one. He was given full reins. Even though there was now a set creative force behind the film, most of the crew were still actually unsure how the character of Jason would actually return in the finished product, but they had major support of the studio from the studio, courtesy of one Frank Mancuso Jr. Now, Mancuso, he was the son of studio head Frank Mancuso Sr., who helped get the first Friday the 13th off the ground. Jr., however, was really, really fresh out of college and was just kind of given the job as associate producer. So, yeah. His dad made this success, and he's like, here, I don't care about the second one. Son, go for it. You need a job, right? Like, that's how that works.
Imagine just being handed an associate producer job fresh out of college.
See? And now, normally, that would be, like, straight up, like, a bad situation. Like, bad. But Mancuso Jr. actually did not take his duties lightly. This kid was fucking hungry. Yeah. I mean, he was the son of the studio president.
Right.
So he was just, he probably had that gumption inside of him. So for being such a young producer, he actually worked really hard to make sure Friday the 13th Part 2 was the best film that it could be. He worked with the crew. He worked as a roving crew member. So he actually did the dirty work and learned how to make a film from the ground up, which I think is fucking cool. Normally I'd talk shit.
Right. I think that's like, really admirable, actually.
Yeah, yeah. He knew his privilege, and he was like, okay, now I'm going to take advantage of this, which is actually pretty badass. Mancuso developed a huge love for this franchise and will go on to shepherd the sequels from here, actually. The team nearly got effects legend Stan Winston, who would go on to do the effects for Aliens, Jurassic Park, Predator, and The Terminator.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. But a scheduling conflict forced him to drop out of the film, and he was replaced by Carl Fullerton, who was in his early 20s at the time and didn't actually have much of a resume. Yeah, poor guy.
Oh, you mean the guy who did the special effects of the poor guy in a wheelchair taking a sword to the face?
Right, and they're like, you know, he fell bad. Let's just flash frame it.
Bad guy?
However, this young special makeup effects artist was given one really monumental task, creating the look of the new killer Jason Voorhees. But first, they had to cast him and a few others. So,
oh, yeah.
But let us know a little bit about Jason, Alex.
Hell yeah. Which, speaking of, because the title of this is His Name Was Jason. Mm-hmm. Have you seen the documentary? About Friday the 13th as
like a franchise?
I've seen
a couple of them, yeah. I've seen, okay, Crystal Lake Memories, and I believe His Name Was Jason.
Yeah, because there's the one that's called His Name Was Jason, and mm-hmm. it's like 30 years, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. I've seen that one. Okay. Actually,
it's on Shudder, I believe.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
Okay, I think I found like a shittier quality version on YouTube.
Okay, yeah. No, yeah. I'm pretty sure it's either on Hulu or Shudder.
Yeah, I think I used that and also Crystal Lake Memories. Because they do half an hour on Pride Sleep Part 2, which is where some of this information actually comes from also.
See?
Lots of good behind the scenes.
Tying it all together.
Right? We work hard on this podcast, fellas. Like, seriously. We watch and interviews. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
But you get the goods.
Finding the right actor to portray Jason was initially a daunting task. And by the end of it, the crew would have to contend with two actors playing the part. And we'll explain why.
Yeah.
The first person asked to portray Jason was Tazo Stravaskis, who had assisted Tom Savini in the original Friday the 13th and portrayed the killer in many scenes. He turned down the role and described it as the biggest regret of his career. He only turned it down because Savini was not working on the film.
See, this is back when they were still like real filmmakers.
Damn.
Everybody was like, no, there's like an honor system here.
Yeah.
And then Friday the 13th is not honor based at all.
No. The crew then thought they found their man in Warrington Gillette.
Fucking Hollywood-ass name. I'm Warrington Gillette. I'm here to play the part of Jason Voorhees.
Jason Voorhees, also Hollywood-a shit name.
Yeah.
Who had initially sought a different role in the film. However, that role went to John Fury. Furry.
I love John Fury as the name. Oh, dude. That would be a fucking name. That guy could play Jason. Jason played by John Fury. Get him a machete!
And Gillette somehow scrambled to make himself stand out to the filmmakers. I think it actually might be Fury.
It could totally be. We could be fucking this up.
Fuck. He then lied to producers, telling them that he had stunt acting experience. That's a horrible thing to lie about.
No,
never lie about your stunt experience.
This Warrington Gillette may not be the brightest bulb.
No.
No.
No, no, no. The producers were in desperate need of someone who could act and do the necessary complex stunt work and hired him.
Mm.
Mistake.
Yep.
Carl Fullerton developed the look of Jason after a day, using the facial deformities from the first template and aging it up with a red beard and overalls. When it came to the iconic pillowcase?
Pillowcase, I think it is, yes.
I don't know, I think it's like a burlap sack?
Yeah.
Or something.
Series of rags?
Yeah. I don't know. The idea actually came from the costume designer, who felt a pillowcase would be kind of readily available. It would be the kind of readily available item that Jason can put on the fly.
Yeah.
I really thought it was a burlap sack. It kind of reminded me of, like, The Strangers.
Oh yeah, they probably referenced that a little bit. But then if you right next, they kind of jocked it from another movie actually.
Oh, The Town That Dreaded Sundown. Yeah, that's also what I was thinking.
Yeah, The Town That Dreaded Sundown actually is, but it was one of those things where people are like, "We didn't steal it." We didn't steal it. And everybody's like, "But it looks just
they're like
no. Yeah. No, it was around the set."
So it was speculated that the killer's outfit did come from the 1976 film The Town That Dreaded Sundown, mm-hmm. which is based off of the famous Texarkana murders,
that's right.
Yes.
Oh, we should cover that.
Which are
that.
Some pretty famous unsolved murders in Texarkana.
Mm-hmm. And that movie had actually a pretty big impact when it aired.
It had a huge impact because it was widely considered one of the first, it's also considered one of the first slasher films as well.
If you guys want an episode of The Town That Dreaded Sundown and you're listening to this, let us know, because that sounds like a fun
one,
actually.
I'd love to cover it.
Yeah,
let's
do it.
I would love to cover it.
Put that on the list. All right.
On his first day on the job, after 6 hours of makeup.
6 hours of makeup, 6 hours of makeup. Remember that.
Okay. Warrington Gillette was set to jump through a cabin window for the film's finale as the unmasked Jason. After a few takes, the crew realized that Gillette was not, in fact, a stunt actor, but rather a regular-ass actor who could not handle complex stunt work.
Yep.
Fuck.
Bad. Don't lie about your stunt work with actor and fucking waste the makeup artist's day.
Gosh. Apparently, he had a very hard time breaking the window, and on one attempt, didn't even shatter it, but rather hit his head against the glass very hard.
Yep.
Oh,
yeah.
Man.
Oh, imagine being there, and he's just like, I'm gonna do it! I'm gonna do it! No shatter, just thud.
And then everyone just a resounding ooh.
It's like, who hired this fucking guy?
Yeah. This put the crew in a bad spot, and Gillette soon abandoned the production, citing injuries, leaving Steve Miner and the producers to search for a new Jason while filming.
Oh, Gillette, you son of a bitch.
Oh, man. And yikes. Okay, so stunt coordinator Cliff Cudney? Had a solution. His friend, former cop, and current out-of-work actor Steve Daskowice, who met Cudney while playing a cop in The Jazz Singer, Daskowice, who changed his last name Dash, drove to Connecticut the day after being cast to find himself with the respect of the crew for his stunt work, and quite a few emergency room visits, which we'll detail in a bit as they're spread out among some of the usual Hollywood bullshit. Let's talk about said Hollywood bullshit as well as some real unfortunate real world bullshit.
Yeah, yeah, this is a good mix of both coming here. So for the Hollywood mix, the mix of both, just a shitstorm coming at you, we're going to talk about the heroine for the first film, Adrienne King. She played the sole survivor Alice in the first Friday the 13th film and was not in a great place when the sequel was actually swinging into production. As mentioned in our last episode on Friday the 13th, Adrienne King had found herself with a stalker, someone who had manipulated their way into her life and sought her out because she looked like someone who had wronged him. However, gets a little crazier than that. The stalker would leave her photos of what she was doing the night before in takeout menus right at her front door. Yeah, and this being New York City, the stalker was able to just blend in with the masses of the people afterwards.
I think what's worse is, like, I love getting takeout menus. Yeah. Like, it's so nice.
They're awesome.
It's very exciting. I have, like, because also, here's the thing, and also, I get it, this is the 80s, so I'm sure they were much more common, but I don't get them much anymore.
No,
in the year of our Lord 2019.
We just get Facebook ads, which we actually run.
So. Yeah, right. Yeah. But, like, we get Facebook ads, or, like, you know, everything's, like, it's all on DoorDash or Yelp or whatever. Mm-hmm. But,
try our biscuits.
Yeah, but I get them sometimes in the mail, and I have one, like, magneted to my fridge right now, and it makes me very happy. So to think, like, in the 80s to have received one and then have photos of what I was doing the previous night inside of them, it's very frightening.
Imagine you being freaked, like a picture, an image of you in a Polaroid of you being freaked out by that possum. just looking out your window like, is he gonna fucking move? Then you're like, oh, he saw the possum too. Oh, wait, where's that come from?
Which is funny because also I did post it to my Instagram, so then everyone saw it, because, like, then so then it just that just makes me think about, like, how easy it is to stalk people these days.
Oh my gosh, so much easier right now. This took effort. Yeah.
This took obnoxious effort.
Yeah, right? Oh, anyways, but during this time, though, there were almost no legal protections for celebrities who had been targeted by stalkers. And
There was no protections for stalkers in general.
Yeah.
This is at the time. I'm watching a really, really intense Discovery show right now about stalkers.
Mm-hmm. Does it talk about, like, Sandra Bullock and all that stuff?
No, it's not about celebrities. It's just everyday people. Oh, everyday. And it is some crazy as fuck shit.
Dude,
it's called, like, Obsessed or something. It's on Investigation Discovery. It's on Hulu. Highly recommend it if you're into true crime.
Ooh.
I also have, like, a weird, like, I am terrified of stalkers.
Yeah, me
too. So I watch stuff with it all the time because it freaks me out and I just need it.
And, like, it could be, like, the Case File episodes on stalkers. Yeah. Ooh, my
oh,
gosh.
My gosh.
The Ella Tundra one fucking freaks me the fuck out.
Yeah, no, that all... But yeah, anyway, where was I going with this? Point is, at this time, especially in the 80s, especially if you were a celebrity, there is so little you can do.
Yes.
If you are a victim of stalking,
mm-hmm.
like, outside of, like, literally the police catching this person with a knife at your throat.
Yeah.
Like, they can't do much of anything.
Oh yeah, and it comes through with Adrienne King because she was one of the first final girls. She's one of the first final girls, and her star was actually rising really significantly.
Yeah.
But even with all this, her agents pressured her not to say anything. They literally were like, don't talk, don't do anything. You're going to be perceived as crazy by the public. Like, just be quiet. And, like, to have no fucking support while this is happening. And nobody's willing to listen. So because of all this and, like, her career taking off, she had to choose. Like, was she going to be quiet and be stopped, or is she just going to have to figure out a way around it? So she asked them.
Yeah.
One simple request, give her as little screen time as possible in the sequel. That made her famous. That kind of sucks. She had to kind of throw it all away a little bit. Like, yeah. just do less for me. Like, ugh.
That sucks.
Yeah.
But I also understand because she was just, like, trying to, like, keep herself safe.
Safe, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. She's in a really, really bad spot. And again, around this time, there was no support. Actually, what was also happening at the same time with her stalker issues was her agent was going a little rogue. Yeah. And he was asking for a higher salary, which the studio was not willing to provide. So Adrian King, unbeknownst to her, was becoming a burden on the production.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this was all done behind her back. So this left King in actual mystery as to what her role would be in the sequel. But she would soon find out when she actually made her way onto set. So when Adrian King finally arrived to set on her first day, she was giving some less than encouraging news. The sole survivor, Alice, would be the first casualty of the film. Yep. She actually wasn't even given a script. No. Yeah, she was not given the script. She had not actually specifically requested to be killed off, but the decision was made, and she ran into another issue with the lack of the script. She had to improvise all of her dialogue.
Wow.
Yeah, and I don't think she was an improv actress.
No, well, also, she didn't... I mean, she only had a couple of lines, and that was just on the phone.
On the phone.
With her mom.
With her mom. She had to make up that whole conversation on the fly, actually.
Really?
Yep, and it was shot over 2 days.
It took 2 days?
Yeah, that and the actual killing part.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that all happened. However, they also didn't have a Jason at this point in time, so they had costume designer Ellen Letter stand in as the feet of the killer while he was stalking Alice. This is the only time that in the whole franchise that Jason is actually played by a female, which is pretty cool.
So basically, they're just like in the background, you just see like Jason's like petite woman feet, yeah. And it's just like Jason has like ballerina feet. This is amazing.
Like, oh, put on baggy pants and shoes. We can't have this.
If only Jason had gotten out of Camp Crystal Lake, he would have had a wonderful future as a dancer. No,
dude, him working in like him like running through the woods and eating crawfish, like he's got to be a petite Jason.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, come on.
I know they make him as like this like really burly, like kind of like not like muscular, but like very like kind of like
Like a sturdy, hardy kind of motherfucker.
I know,
yeah.
Kind of like sturdy, but like not overpowering, but like definitely like a presence, you mm-hmm. know? And I just think that's so funny because I'm like, this motherfucker has been like learning how to survive like by himself for 35 fucking years.
Right? He's like, all eating berries and shit.
Yeah. Like, he doesn't know.
Oh my gosh. But yeah, the other crew members actually also stood in for the hands and other portion of Jason as well. So like this is, again, this is Friday the 13th. They don't have money sometimes and it's just kind of all makeshift. But to add injury to insult, during one of the takes, or during the first take actually, for Alice's death, the ice pick didn't properly retract and ended up injuring her temple
when
it hit her. Yeah. With that, she was sent home. And her time with the franchise was now over.
Wow.
So they made her film a scene where someone was stalking her and murdering her while she was, you know, having a real-life stalker. Yeah. And they didn't give her a script, made her improvise her dialogue, cut her completely character from the franchise forever. And actually hurt her and sent her ass home.
Okay, but in their defense, they didn't know she actually had a stalker.
No, they knew.
Oh, I thought her agent told her to keep it under wraps.
No, I may have skipped over that part. They still told the producers that she did have a stalker as well. So they knew, and they still made her film the scene the way it was fucking done.
That's kind of fucked up.
Yeah, a little fucked up. Anyways, the team still needed a leading lady to play the final girl in the film. And they cast former model / All My Children actress Amy Steele to play the part of Ginny Fields, a character named after the production designer Virginia Fields. Steele was 20 when she got the leading role. Now that the filmmakers solved their Alice Hardy dilemma, very, very fucked up, hired their final girl and their mass killer, as well as a slew of teenage fodder, production was ready to really kick in. And what's a little Friday the 13th production without numerous onset incidents and injuries?
I say not a Friday the 13th film at all, Anthony Fuentes.
No, you need to have at least one or two emergency room visits.
Oh, yeah. Filming took place in New Preston and Kent, Connecticut during the fall of 1980 and lasted actually only around a month.
Yeah, yeah. It's cheap.
Yeah. The actors stayed in the cabins on set, and one night the actors who played Paul, Jeff, and Scott decided to play a prank on actress Lauren Marie Taylor, who played Vicky. They scratched her screen window in a creepy enough way that she began hyperventilating. She ended up hyperventilating so severely that she had fainted.
Yeah. They scared her almost to death.
That's so bad.
Yeah.
While the prank may or may not have soured her opinion on that particular set of actors, Lauren Marie Taylor was developing a genuine crush on her on-screen boyfriend, Mark, played by Tom McBride. Unfortunately for her, McBride was gay and used to turning down the advances of interested women. We're unsure if this also caused Lauren Marie Taylor to faint.
That's funny, though. When I saw the interview, he was like, she was like gushing about him. She was like, you know, and he's so handsome and blah, blah, blah. And then they cussed him. He's like, yeah, I'm used to turning down lots of ladies. I'm sorry. Okay. Like, he was so used to, like, I know you guys like me, but she's not there.
Not my type. Betsy Palmer, who played Mrs. Voorhees in the first film, was asked to come back, much to her surprise. She filmed her scenes in front of a black screen, and it took about half a day. She would later forget that she actually did this, and has never actually seen the second Friday the 13th film.
Yeah, I remember thinking it was like a panel or something. She's like, yeah, the only one I was in, whatever, was the first one, and somebody was like, you raise your hand, you were in the second one. She's like, oh. What? Okay.
Whatever you say.
Yeah.
I think I would know.
Yeah.
Au contraire. Another returning actor was Walt Gorney, who played Crazy Ralph in the first film. Which, okay, pause.
Pause.
First of all, when I saw this, I was just like, of all the fucking people to come back, you're gonna bring back Crazy Ralph?
Yeah.
You're gonna bring back this motherfucker?
It's like... incomprehensible way of speaking.
It's just like, you're all gonna die. Yeah. Like, what? Speaks in riddles?
Yeah. He's all ambiguous.
Yeah, like, can't you just be specific for once in your life, motherfucker? So, he was seen walking around the set and talking to himself, which most of the crew found odd, but they just assumed he was getting into character.
Yeah. They're like, please be him getting into character.
The original impaling scene involving Sandra and Jeff went longer and featured full frontal nudity. However, it was later discovered that Marta Kobler, who played Sandra, was actually underage, so the sex was cut down and any scenes with nudity were deleted by Paramount.
Damn. Yikes. Damn. Good thing they're gone from the earth.
Oh, yeah. They're yeah. gone. They deleted yeah. it. Paramount, like, took the final, the footage and, like, lit it on fire and was just like, no one needs to know.
It was like, listen, you can injure your actors, screw people's careers, whatever, but accidental that pedophilia, we can't handle that shit.
Those are underage nipples. My
yeah.
Give
yeah.
it 3 more months and they're no longer underage nipples.
3 more months. They're like, damn it!
Good lord. It's ridiculous.
Oh, that's funny.
When it came to nudity they could actually use, the film ended up establishing the popular horror trope of skinny dipping equals death, thanks to the scene involving Kirsten Baker and Russell Todd.
See, rules are being made right here and there.
Which is a fantastic trope, because again, also, I don't know how many people actually go skinny dipping this much in real life.
No. Like, people just get naked at home now.
Well, also, like, I don't think that many people actually want to get naked in public and swim in, like,
with the amount of cameras that are around now.
Well,
and all that,
and then also, like, I don't know, I just...
Our water's worse.
Exactly. Russell Todd's character, Scott, is also the first character killed by Jason Voorhees' signature machete.
Yep. See, everything's getting started in this film. It's
this
awesome.
This film establishes the
Jasonisms.
Hallmarks. I was gonna say the hallmarks of the Friday the 13th franchise.
Yeah, that's
but yeah,
true.
Jasonisms.
I like
too.
Jason, and also some slasher rules that were still being developed.
I like how mine was all wordy. I'm like, the hallmarks of Friday the 13th, and you're just like, Jason.
Jason shit.
When it comes to legitimate injuries, Warrington Gillette may have had the right idea to avoid the film, as his replacement, Steve Dash, ended up with a couple of them.
Yeah. this is some bad ones.
The first was during a scene where Jason chases Ginny through a forest. While filming, Steve Dash ended up missing his mark and falling on his pitchfork, breaking four of his ribs.
Yeesh.
Mm-hmm. His next injury wasn't too far off. During the filming of the climactic scene with Jason and Ginny, Amy Steele was supposed to bring down the machete on a very specific spot on Steve Dash's pickaxe. During the first take, Dash was not quick enough, and Steele brought the machete down on his finger.
Real-life machete, by the way.
Ow!
Yep.
Dash was then quickly taken to the emergency room for stitches.
He almost lost a finger.
Ow.
He almost lost a finger. Yeah.
Ow. He returned to set as quick as he could, was given a prosthetic cover for his injured finger, and finished the scene.
Mm-hmm. Dash is a fucking G, dude.
Yeah.
He's taking hits.
Yeah, he is taking one for the motherfucking team.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately for Dash, his credit for Jason would be relegated to that of Stunt Jason, as the team had no time or money to refit the prosthetics for his face, and they needed to film one more scene with the unmasked Jason.
Mm-hmm.
The producers were forced to bring Warrington Gillette back on set, and thus he received the final credit as Jason Voorhees, even if it was only for one scene. Fuck you!
Seriously, Warrington. Fucking lying piece of shit. I don't even know. He seemed like a nice guy in all the interviews, to be honest with you. But at the same time,
the fact that they still interviewed him and he was just like, I just lied my ass off.
Yeah.
That sucks. An alternate ending was shot, which had actress Connie Hogan sit under a table and play the head of Mrs. Voorhees, who would reanimate and smile towards the camera in the final shot of the film. Are we going to talk about this, by the way?
That
final shot of the film?
We can.
Here's the thing. It made no sense to me. I didn't understand it at all.
Oh, no. Making sense is not a Friday the 13th thing.
Okay. I wasn't sure if I was just really high or if it was just, like, thrown in there for gratuitous, like...
It was one... Because I think all the films have, like, one of those stinger endings that they don't even acknowledge in the next one.
Okay.
Like, literally almost every single one of these films has that.
Okay. I was just like, what the entire fuck?
Yeah.
Because I really thought I missed something. So I was like, I thought I was paying attention. And then I got to the end and I was like...
No, it's literally one of those things. It's just a Friday the 13th thing. It's weird.
Cool. Upon seeing the ending, the filmmakers felt it was kind of stupid and just used a freeze frame of the head cast after Betsy Palmer and sent the now-finished Friday the 13th Part 2 to the dun-dun-dun MPAA.
Oh, and you know how it goes with the MPAA. Of course, based off last week, although it kind of favored Craven, Steve Miner's no Wes Craven. So now we're going to see the full power of the MPAA.
Oh,
now,
yeah.
They were actually embarrassed by how many graphic scenes they allowed in the final cut of the first Friday the 13th film. And they came down hard on its sequel. Like, hard. There were two major death scenes that were cut severely for the film. The first involving the character of Scott. In the film, Scott has his throat slit while hanging upside down. In the original cut, a huge blood spill results from the throat slitting thanks to a tube attached to the actor's leg. It was actually a pretty complex stunt, and it was a lot of blood.
Yeah.
The next cuts were to the impalement scene involving Sandra and Jeff. The original effect had the scene filmed in full with a complex mechanism that allowed for the spear to look as if it went through the actor and the blood effects to be pumped out when needed. It was masterful work, actually, by the very last minute special effects artist Carl Fullerton. It was one of the more complex bits mm-hmm. of the film. None of these effects would be seen, however, as the MPAA was determined to neuter the final cut of the film thanks to recent political backlash against violent media, which targeted slashers in particular as they were gaining popularity fast. Thanks,
maybe,
Reagan.
And well, also maybe that's also a hallmark of sequels.
Yeah, yeah.
Being blamed for violent media being like a catalyst for violence.
Right? You're what's wrong with the children.
Yeah. But I think what's also interesting, and I don't know if it, because honestly, I love Friday the 13th, like the concept, but I haven't seen a lot of the sequels.
Oh.
Like, I haven't, like, this is the first time you're seeing the second one. I haven't seen the third one. Like, I haven't seen a lot of them.
There's a lot of them.
There are a lot of them. Yeah. But I love, like, the lore, kind of, right?
Yeah.
So, I'm very excited to see how it continues. But I do think it's very interesting between the first one and the second one. Someone gets impaled through a bed.
Yeah. just keeps happening.
Yeah, between Kevin Bacon and these guys. Mm-hmm. Like, they just...
An underage girl and just other dude.
Yeah. Yikes.
Oh, but, my gosh.
Yeah, I just think it's very interesting.
Right? And then, the thing is with Friday the 13th sequels... When it comes to the MPAA, and we're going to cover all of them at some point, I'm sure, guys. But it's one of those things where culture changes around them. So some sequels are able to get away with a lot more gore because people stop giving a shit. And then it comes back.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, what does he think of the children? And then it gets neutered again in, like, you know, 7 or whatever. So this is a thing that Friday the 13th always kind of comes across. It may actually, though, be better as that the scene was actually cut because it was being cited as plagiarism. Thanks to a similar scene appearing in Mario Bava's Twitch of the Nerve, which is an Italian giallo film. Which, again, this film has a lot of giallo qualities to it, which is pretty cool. But yeah, they think that it actually, again, it's it stole from The Town That Dreaded Sundown and Mario Bava's film.
Curious!
They're just pulling some influences here. But the MPAA still threatened the film with the next rating, and the cuts went through as suggested. I think it was just over a minute or just under a minute of cuts, but it's all like the effects.
Oh.
Like every little, you know, 5-10 second thing of
which
effects.
Which sucks because so much work goes into those effects.
Seriously. So when Friday the 13th Part 2 finally was released to the public, it was met with very negative reviews and mixed reaction from fans who were also skeptical about the return of Jason. I would put the review stuff in here, but literally it would just everybody shat on it.
Oh, that sucks.
Ebert shat on it. Siskel shat. Everybody shat on it. Like, nobody liked this fucking film. At least critically. But it also didn't help that it opened in a very, very crowded year for horror films, with high-profile releases being pumped out constantly, such as, and here's a few of them, Halloween 2, The Omen 3, The Final Conflict, The Evil Dead, The Howling, and My Bloody Valentine.
Woo!
Yep. This amounted to the film making less money than the first Friday the 13th. But since the budget was so low, Paramount was already ready for a sequel. So during this time period, though, Adrian King's stalker would at last be arrested after a year and a half of torment. But it had a lasting effect on the actress, unfortunately. She mostly relegated herself to voice work for the remainder of her career. Which, at least she had a career. That's nice. But she had to go to therapy and moved a lot and all this shit. Yeah, it was bad. Steve Dash would finally get his credit as Jason, thanks to appearing in the prologue of the next film, Friday the 13th Part 3. And this one would actually be spearheaded by young college grad Frank Mancuso Jr. as the producer. He was finally given a shot to guide the franchise forward.
Awesome.
Not bad for his early fucking 20s getting this job. Sensing that Friday the 13th was no longer a top contender in the slasher genre, the team would have to up their game when it came to pushing the boundaries of good taste, as well as find a way to make Jason truly scary. All it would take is an even bigger disregard for continuity and a certain hockey mask that would turn the mask killer from a struggling slasher villain to a true piece of film iconography and a legend in the horror genre. And you'll hear all about that when we do Friday the 13th Part 3, probably sometime in 2020, but not this year.
2020 is not a real year.
Yeah. I can't even believe it's fucking happening, to be honest with you. That's weird. But yeah, Friday the 13th Part 3, you guys will get that story at some point. Yeah. But that is the production and how we got Friday the 13th Part 2. Yay! We did it!
We made it!
Right? So, Alex?
I'm genuinely surprised that there wasn't as much praise for the movie.
Yeah.
All things considered. Because watching it, all things considered, it's a pretty good movie.
Well, to me, I always look at it like it was still in that, like, confused time in slasher history.
Yeah.
Like, people really didn't understand, like, why are you bringing back Jason? Like, even fans were just kind of like, okay. Were they put a bag on his head, like, kind of thing?
Were they kind of just like, oh, this was just fine as a one-off?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that kind of thing. And then it was, like, part two, they bring Jason back, and, like, the critics were just hounding on it. And then, media attention was always negative. That still brought people's asses in seats, obviously.
Of course.
$21 million on that budget's nothing to scoff at. But, yeah, it was a very confusing time for the franchise, so they had to re-gear. And so when we hit the next one, you're going to see how they bounce back, obviously. But, yeah, this is one of those transitional ones. But to me, yeah, I think it was really just, like, the scene around it put a negative light on the film. But when you look at it in retrospect, it's really a hidden gem in the franchise. And it's probably one of my favorites now after having seen it compared to all the other films.
I haven't seen all of the other ones, but I think I like this just as much as the first one.
I liked it more than the first one, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I thought it was way better made.
I thought it was better made. I think also I liked the characters a lot more than the first one.
Yeah. Okay. That's actually something I kind of wanted to talk about too.
Well, okay. Let's start right up at the top then.
Yeah.
So right off the bat, what were your thoughts on this film?
Well, see, as we're talking about right now, this one to me, again, it's like a secret Italian giallo film. It has you know what it is? I made this high thought in my head the other day. It's like a John Carpenter film if he had a not good script. If he had a not good script, it was just like, okay, we're just going to toss some shit in the wind. And you gave somebody who was like, okay, well, I'm going to try to copy John Carpenter as much as possible then, and then turn this into something.
All right.
That would be this film.
I can see it.
Right? There's a lot of, like, single takes and slow, like, voyeuristic shots, which is something that, like...
It is pretty voyeuristic.
Right? They don't do that the later ones. They kind of do, but it's more gratuitous.
I think it's a little bit more art.
It is
in this one, which was very surprising.
There's like an actual auteurship to the film.
There's some auteurship, but then also it's kind of paired with abrupt, swift, graphic violence.
Yeah.
And I think that I can imagine in the 80s that can be very jarring for some viewers.
Mm-hmm.
But I really liked it.
Me too. Honestly, I thought it was great. And then again, it's got a real good look to it, and it's kind of creepy sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, the actual nighttime stalkery scenes, like, there's a particular shot with Jason, approaching one of the girls. She's the one that wanted to have sex with the wheelchair guy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, when she's dying, and he's just slowly, one POV shot, has the knife right in front of the camera, and she's out of focus, but they don't cut away.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just slowly coming out. And then she comes in focus, and the knife's right fucking there. That's brilliant.
Yeah.
That's fucking brilliant. This is actually really good filmmaking.
Well, you also get really great POV shots from Jason in this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really, really cool. Because, like, you kind of get it in the first one, but it's, like, it's cut really weird. And
it's cheap.
Like, it's cheap. It's blurry. I also, obviously, they use it a lot in this film, but you get a lot of the
oh, yeah.
Like, you get a lot of that.
Oh, wait, I didn't even put that in here as a question, but dude, the sound in this,
yeah,
the score is amazing.
It's really good. Well, and of course, like, that, it's iconic, like, that, mm-hmm. that one single sound clip, everyone knows, like, the
yeah.
Like, everyone knows, like, that is, like, Friday the 13th, like, that is, like, Jason's sound moniker at
right?
this point.
And then they roll in these violins, and they really do like a almost Hitchcockian way of letting the sound, like, guide.
Tell the story.
Yeah. Yeah.
I agree. For sure.
So, okay. So what do you think of the film?
I really liked it. I was pleasantly surprised. I am normally not a huge sequel person. So this month I was expecting it to be a challenge. but I really liked it. I really enjoyed myself. Again, very high.
Yeah.
But I did enjoy it. Mm-hmm. It was, I mean, obviously I love the Friday the 13th, like, franchise.
Yeah.
Like, Jason, I like the whole lore behind Jason. I just think it's a really cool story.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very enjoyable for me in a way that I wasn't expecting it to be. It had all of the components of, like, a traditional slasher film,
mm-hmm.
but it also had the artsy elements that, like, made it not feel overly aged for
yeah.
a movie that's, like, at this point almost, like, what, 40 years old?
Yeah. Oh my god, is it? You're right.
Yeah.
Fuck.
Yeah.
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, the movie's almost 40 years old,
that sucks.
It's It's 38 years old right
that,
now.
That hurts. Yeah. All right, everybody, I'm feeling it now. That's bad.
So the movie's 38 years old, and it didn't feel like a 38-year-old movie.
It didn't. And that's the thing. I remember, again, watching it when I was younger. It was always on a CRT. Mm-hmm. It always severely diminished the quality. But when I see it now, this is way better looking than a lot of the films that come from this time.
Yeah.
Like, surprisingly so. And Steve Miner, for his directorial debut.
No, he did a great job. It was a fantastic. It was a really well done film, especially for a slasher film with a low budget. Especially, like, I mean, it wasn't like super low, but it was low for the time. With a low budget, someone's first directorial like film,
and no rules.
Yeah,
it had nothing. No framework to work with. Really, like, it developed a lot of these within this film.
I mean, really, they had like this like ragtag crew of like people where they were just like, this shouldn't work.
Yeah,
like,
it was the B team.
Yeah, it was the B team, and like they put everyone together. And technically, this film should not have worked.
Mm-hmm.
Like, technically, with everyone that they had, this film should have been absolute garbage. But they worked their asses off.
Yeah, dude.
And it shows.
Mm-hmm.
And I think something really great came out of it.
Yeah,
and I think the more I talk about it, the more I'm just like, justice for Friday the 13th Part 2. This is really good.
Yeah,
like,
right?
Totally underrepresented.
I honestly, every list, I know it is a fan favorite, kinda.
Yeah.
But, like, it's one of those, like, some fans, like a vocal minority of the fan base is like, no, this is actually the blah, blah, whatever. Like, I used to always think they were just being contrarian. But
right.
Then I watch it now, I'm like, you guys have some ammunition, actually.
You have some points.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think also a lot of people wait until Friday the 13th Part 3 because that's when Jason gets the mask. And that's because, and a lot of people don't realize that. And obviously, you know, anyone who follows horror knows, you know, Jason does not get his mask until the third movie.
Mm-hmm.
So this one is like that weird in-between where it's like he doesn't quite have like the mask yet, but it's also not a, it's not an introductory tale. So
no,
it's kind of, it's a transitionary film.
Right?
Kind of, between eras for
between
Jason.
Between eras, yes. That's a good way of putting it. Actually, so this is a good question I have for you right here. How do you actually feel about Jason's look and movement relative to other films in the franchise, as well as other slashers at this time?
I think someone watched The Town That Dreaded Sundown right before the brainstorm meeting. I don't know if it was intentionally copying, but I think someone like the week before had watched The Town That Dreaded Sundown or something and had that in the back of their head. I do think the argument that it's like, well, they would have had access to pillows. It was a camp, so there should have been pillowcases, right?
Seems a little bullshitting.
Yeah, that's a bullshit excuse.
Yeah.
I personally, if it was like a burlap sack or something, I think that would have been a little bit more understandable.
Mm-hmm.
But also, if you're going completely off of like rationalization, if this person had grown up in the forest, he would have grown up completely without shame. Like,
yeah, that's true.
He wouldn't have felt the need to cover his face.
Oh, look at you, Miss Child Psychologist Alex Webster over here.
I'm just saying.
No, I'm with Ginny.
I know. But, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I think it was a bullshit excuse. But I also understand that, like, they probably didn't have the money to, like, do,
see?
You know.
And you're stickler for logic here.
I know.
It's not the franchise. And it's a sequel to a franchise that already doesn't give a shit about logic.
I know. I'll let it go. But, you know, but I think that I appreciate the look because I do think that, like, people don't like masks. People don't like their faces being covered.
Mm-hmm.
I did think of The Strangers. I did think of The Town That Dreaded Sundown. I think that, you know, those kind of aesthetics are kind of definitely prevalent. But yeah, I didn't mind it. I definitely was just like, as like I think most people are whenever they watch a Friday the 13th movie, they're like, where's the hockey mask?
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it'll be really cool to see the dawning of the hockey mask when we do
when we
three.
Finally do it. Yeah. But I think in this film Jason is a little Michael Myers-y in the way that he moves, because he's like super natural. In the later films, he's like a husk, and he's just like, he just goes. In this one, he actually has to like plot out his points, and he gets beat up, and like he's a little more human.
In this one,
I
can definitely see that, and I think in the later films, again with most of like the classic slasher, you know,
icons,
they all have that supernatural edge to them because in the beginning. Before for Halloween, Michael Myers was just a guy.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, he was just a guy.
He was a medicine guy, but he was just a guy. Yeah. He can get knocked out.
Yeah,
you know. Poked in the eye and shit. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. He was just a guy. He was weird as fuck, but he was just a guy.
Mm-hmm.
I think similar thing here. Technically, he was supposed to be, like, in his 40s.
Yeah, some bullshit, right?
Or, like, he was supposed to be, like, in his 30s or something.
I can't even... The continuity is too much to try to actually, like, compute.
Technically, you're, like, Jason age in,
like... I know, right? But, like, me just stuck in the woods, like...
Yeah.
Why are they fucking?
I got a... Like, poke him.
You want penetration, huh?
But yeah, I think that... It was very, I don't know, I think that the supernatural elements become a lot more, like, they added an additional flair in the later movies,
mm-hmm.
But he does have a Michael Myers type of, like, walk.
He does,
like,
yeah.
Like, a stance.
He kind of, like, glides into and out of scenes, yeah. And then when he fights, it's like a struggle, it's like yeah. a overpowering
yeah.
kind of thing.
Yeah, well, he also has that, like that standing in a corner, but the person that he's watching doesn't realize they're being watched.
Yeah.
That type of vibe, which did give me some, I remember thinking, again, high thought, like thinking while I was watching it, like, this is kind of like Michael Myers-y, like in mm-hmm. the beginning
yeah.
with Adrian King, like that scene.
Oh yeah, that's right. God, poor Adrian King. If you guys hear barking, there's an asshole dog
again,
next door.
Yeah, again, not my. We're recording at my apartment today, so.
But oh, okay.
Not as silent.
Anyway, but how actually did you feel about Ginny as the final girl?
I didn't hate it.
I actually really liked her.
Yeah, I liked her. I thought she was sweet.
She was kind of smarter than everyone else in this fucking film.
Child psychologist.
She was she actually tried to get into, like, the legend, like, of what would make Jason do the things that everybody's kind of freaked out about he could be doing. And, mm-hmm. like, in the bar scene, she was just like, well, you know, he probably saw his mother get killed and whatever. And you get the comic relief. Oh, by the way, forgot to put that in. One of the establishment of the comic relief character trope, this film as well. One of the earliest ones was the weirdo friend that was with... Yeah. And he didn't die.
No.
He lived.
Well, you know what's so funny is when I realized the amount of people at that camp, I was like, this is too many people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's no way there he can kill all of these people. And then when they split up and mm-hmm. they were like, oh, some of us are going to go into town and get drinks. And then all the horny ones are just like, we're going to stay back here and fuck.
Yeah, we gonna fuck.
When that happened, I was like, oh, you guys are the ones that are going to die.
Yeah. Well, think about it, though. Usually it's the party animals that get murked.
Yeah.
I mean, and the people who fuck, obviously. Right. But Jason had to make a choice. He had to make a choice.
Well, because they went out to, like, a bar. It wasn't like they were hitting out, like the club. Like,
no,
you
you're
know,
right.
It wasn't like they were, like, getting dressed up, getting all pretty or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Like, these people, like, they were staying back specifically so they could fuck.
That's right.
Like, so, and I think, and also, I do think that sex equals death overpowers drinking equals death.
Yeah, you're right,
I think I think all of these people were over 21
mm-hmm.
and some are like, you know, they were like...
They were supposed to be of drinking age.
Yeah, I think they were of drinking age, so mm-hmm. at that point, they're not even breaking any rules.
They're not. This is surprisingly, like, not adhere to standards film.
Well, they're still being established, so of course, because, mm-hmm. like, some rules are still being established, and some stick better than others.
Yeah, because you think about it, the final girl's not virginal. She's fucking her boss.
Yeah.
She's fucking her boss. And, like, you know, she's kind of a smartass, and, like, all this other stuff. She's not a final girl.
No, she's not, she's not a virgin. She's not any of these, like, very typical tropes that you see with final girls sometimes. Like, she's definitely not in high school.
Nope, definitely not in high school.
She's definitely
in
college.
She's not naive either.
No, she's very smart. I mean, but then again, you know, she, so I think it sets, I think the most telling one for me is that she's in college.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one's really, really important because you're looking at someone who's an adult, someone who, as a society, we've decided, like, they can go out and mm-hmm. drink and have sex and do these things and you're not going to look down on someone in the same way you would as you would, like, a high school student who was doing the same thing.
She's not too young and immature to do all the shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's not, like, going out of her way to be like, look at me, fucking da-da-da. Like, and, oh, that bitch deserves that.
Right. But then it's also, you know, she, you're right, she's very witty. She's very mm-hmm. smart. And then she's also, like, very, like, teasy and like flirty with her boss.
Yeah.
And like, cause like when like her car doesn't start and like it totally does start, she just wanted to like put like exhaust in his face.
Yeah.
Like that whole thing. Like, and she was just like all like smug and shit. Like, I just think that all of that, like she's very like intentional.
Yeah. No, honestly, Ginny is probably one of my favorite in the franchise final girls, yeah. But like definitely one of the underrated final girls.
Okay. Definitely. I think, yeah, I can see that. She did a great job. I was going to ask about the teenage fodder, but I think we're going to get right to it. So
yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and ask it. How does the teenage fodder in this one compare to the other slashers, like the fodder, so to speak, in other slashers you've seen?
Oh my God, I love these guys. Like, I think they're all kind of cool.
Yeah. Again, all of these people seem to be adults.
Yeah, and they're not like, it's not like the first film, where the first film, they're all normal and talking, yeah, bullshitting, whatever. But this film, like, they seem to have more of a personality, and they spend just the right amount of time to establish them and then move on to the next one. Because there's 9 victims, I think, total.
Maybe.
Around there.
Yeah.
But, like, you get time with each of them.
Yeah.
Like, and it's, I mean, sure, there's some pervs, like the guy stealing the clothes and whatever it is, but then he gets fucking killed.
So, he gets it, so yeah, it's fine.
The people you don't like get killed mercilessly. People you do like also get killed pretty bad. But you know what? Like, they have fine little moments in the sun. Like, honestly, I really loved the wheelchair guy. I forget the character's name.
Yeah.
And the girl who, like, was, like, all about him. Like, their scenes together, it was so, like, genuine.
Yeah.
They were just like, oh, like, I have questions about you. And he's just like, yeah, well, I can do it.
I think I really, really liked that dynamic. Because also, for me, it was just very cool to see a character with a disability in a horror film. And it sucks that he died. But it was just, like, that's not something that you see, but also, like, it's something that, like, he addresses.
Mm-hmm.
Where he's just like, people don't want to go out with a guy in a wheelchair. And,
yeah,
like, he's kind of, like, kind of beats himself up about it. He's like, I don't feel like going out. Like, no one wants to deal with a drunk guy in a wheelchair.
Yeah, but then he's also like, she's like, well, is it permanent? And he's like, doctor seems to think so, but I'm going to try to get around. Like, he really is still, at the end of the day, he's a glass half full kind of guy.
Yeah.
Like, he's a really good character.
Yeah, no, he's a really good character. And I think it's so interesting because in slasher films, you don't really have characters with disabilities that often.
I mean, you have it in, like, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but that character's, like, a fucking weird-ass, like, he's, like, the opposite of this guy. He's, like, weird and, like, it's just somebody that, like, you're like, okay, he's gonna die.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, or, like, they're making him as reprehensible as possible.
Yeah.
So they can do something.
Well, and you bring up an excellent point. Disability is often used in like, the same connotation or the same breath as bad or wicked or douchey or, like, they're bad people.
They're just like, and so what, I'm a disability, I can still be a piece of shit like everybody else.
No, basically, like, people with disabilities in horror films are often very, very, like, they're either the villains, first of all, or, because even Jason.
Yeah, that's true.
Is disabled. And then you also have, but then you have, like, this character who also is disabled, but he's a good character, and you don't see that. And that's what was so refreshing. It's like, normally the disabled characters are villains.
Yeah, villains or just, like, some comic relief or some shit, you know? Something that they're, like, not given, like, the chance to act like other characters. So he's about to fuck when he dies.
Like, well, they're comic relief, or, like, viewed as, like, sexless objects, which is also huge, like, which is also something that he really appreciated, because, like, definitely, he's, like, about to fuck.
He's waiting to fuck. He's like, okay, she's gonna go to the bathroom, I'm just gonna chill outside and get some fresh air, because it's about to be musty where I'm gonna be.
He is going to fuck.
And she's like, I wanna ride that chair, like, it's all, like, a thing.
It's a thing. It is a confirmed thing.
Oh.
And then he fucking dies. He takes a machete to the fucking head and gets thrown down the stairs.
He gets it nasty. And they don't hold back.
No, they do not. They do not, unfortunately. R.I.P. wheelchair guy.
I know, and the thing is, like, I love how you care enough about the characters. You're like, but I wanted them to fuck. I don't care about the other guys fucking. They're gonna do it. Like, whatever. But, like, these two, like, they make us have a conversation before.
On top of a higher body count, like, from the Scream episode, we also get a lot more fucking.
Oh, yeah. We get a lot of nudity and shit.
Yeah, we get so much fucking in this episode. Or not episode, but, you know.
The film, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, you get the underage sex scene, apparently.
I know. I didn't even know.
No, me neither. I thought she was normal aged.
I know. Well, and I also think, very funny, all of these people, like, I definitely thought were, like, college age.
Yeah, they pulled off the look.
Yeah, mm-hmm. definitely. I definitely thought, like, all these people, like, yeah, you're all in your, like, you know, late teens, mm-hmm. for sure.
Yeah.
So I think it's very interesting how, like, this group of youths. compared to, like the original one, where I'm just like, y'all are obnoxious as shit.
Mm-hmm. Like, I can't wait for you guys to die.
Yeah, because it's, like, very similar age group, but, like, in a way, like, more obnoxious.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I mean, I think it was just, like, the first film, everyone was a little more exaggerated.
Yeah.
And this one, they're a little more grounded. Like, surprisingly grounded.
Surprisingly, the first film was more campy than the second one.
Yeah, that's what I find weird. Don't worry, when we get to third, it's going to be campy as shit.
Oh,
Just so you know. Oh, also, Paul, her boyfriend, even though he's not technically fodder, I did like him as a character.
Yeah.
Like, the way he's talking shit to the sheriff, and he's just like, aren't you going to punish them? And he's just like, make sure they don't get dessert.
No, make sure they can't get seconds.
Seconds, that's right.
They can't get seconds of dessert.
But, like, Paul's just, like, anti-authority.
He's like, fuck you.
Like, listen, I have power, and I'll run my camp how the fuck I want to run my camp. How about that?
How about that?
Okay, cool. And also, I'm going to fucking fight Jason. How about that?
Yeah. So, fucking choke. you suck. So, do you think an increased amount of gore would have helped or hindered the film, now that we know what scenes had been cut for the MPAA rating?
See, I kind of think, like, the cutaways and all the stuff, it actually works to make it feel a little more Hitchcockian, but the particular scenes that got cut, I would like to have seen at least the double penetration step. double impalement.
I understood what you meant, and I'll allow it. Because it's true. It technically is double penetration.
Yeah, right?
So I'll allow it. I wish it was bloodier.
Really?
Yeah. Because, okay. there's an absurd amount of violence, but it wasn't very gory.
No, it's mostly lead up.
Yeah, like, you see the hit, but you don't see the aftermath. And mm-hmm.
Exactly. Hit, no aftermath. You're right.
Yeah, and it's something that, like, you saw a lot because Tom Savini worked mm-hmm. on the first one. You saw a lot of, like, the blood.
Yeah.
And I think that's what made it. It was very blood-soaked, the first one. The second one, a lot more violence, but a lot less gore. And I thought that was an interesting... I mean, I guess it was what they had to do for...
See? But originally, there was more gore. Like, that's the shitty part. I mean, you can go either way. I still think I like as is, and I like the more, like, subtle way it goes about expressing its violence, but I know that it's forced.
Mm-hmm.
So I would actually really love to see the true intention of the film, if we ever found those scenes. But I know most of them are lost, actually. There are still images of some of those scenes on the back of a VHS. The Friday the 13th Part 2 VHS has still images of some of these bloody scenes.
If someone has the Friday the 13th Part 2 VHS, please take a photo and send it to me.
Yeah.
I would love to see it.
See some snapshots.
Yeah, but I'll post it on the Instagram. I don't give a fuck.
How do you feel about the way the production actually handled Adrienne King's stalking and her whole situation with the franchise as the former Final Girl?
I think that... they were little douche canoes about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think they could have handled it better, for sure. But also, I think that stalking was such, like, a new... Well, not new, but, like, it wasn't as widely discussed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think definitely stalking was something that was just kind of swept under the
rug.
Swept
under the rug, yeah.
People didn't want to talk about it. Like, gender-based violence still wasn't as much of a thing people wanted to discuss.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it was... pure ignorance, where people just didn't know how to handle situations regarding stalking or gender-based violence. And I think that led to, like, it was just a detriment to the film.
Yeah.
I think that I'm sure Adrienne King was disappointed.
Like, yeah, she seemed like a little bit.
In how everything was handled.
Mm-hmm.
I wish that, you know, because she obviously deserved better in that respect.
Yeah.
She
deserves at least a script on her first day.
Right. But yeah, I think the production company and mm-hmm. like everyone could have done a little bit better.
They could have been a little more sensitive to her demand, request at least. Yeah.
Yeah, or sensitive to the request, but also, like, not, like, immediately, like, okay, you don't want to be in the film a whole lot, we're just going to kill you off.
Yeah. She even expressed, too, like, if you guys need me for the sequel, like, just let me know. I'll any sequels further on the franchise, I will be a part. and they're like, eh, you're actually gonna die today. Like, ugh.
Which sucks. But yeah, yeah, I think they could have handled it much better. But also on the side of the production company, I don't think, because it was very little talked about, like, regarding, like, sexual violence, I don't think that they knew how to handle the situation outside of, like, what else can we do other than write her off?
Yeah, it was beyond their scope.
Yeah.
It was way beyond their scope.
Which, obviously, that's not an excuse, but I think it probably would have been handled a little bit differently now.
Oh, it would absolutely be handled way differently now. Yeah,
because, like, just, I mean, even Case File has covered, like, a couple episodes.
One of the celebrity stalkers.
One of the celebrity stalkers, yeah. And
that actually helped establish a lot of the rules that would.
Exactly, yeah. That's true. Where it's like, you can't just walk onto a set and be like, hey, I'm here to deliver it for this person that I'm totally not stalking.
Yeah. Well, this is what Adrienne King, too, said, too, in one of her interviews. She was just like, listen, like, you want to think that a stalker's always going to be some weirdo or homeless guy or whatever. Like, a lot of these guys have money. Mm-hmm. A lot of these guys have resources and things like that. Like, they're people.
Yeah.
And they blend in, like, with any other person. So they're, you know, you may think that you're okay, but realistically you're not.
And that's where it gets so fucking scary, because it's like, it's literally anyone.
All right. Now with that, though, kill of the film. Kill of the film,
ooh,
Alex.
Let's see. Oh my gosh. One of them scared the shit out of me, and I'm trying desperately to remember which one. Because one of them, I was just like, ooh. One of them actually made me, like, gasp.
Gasp? Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I want to know which one it is. Fucking wheelchair guy, though. His kill, I think.
Yeah.
That one hurt a little bit. I mean, it was kind of cheaply at the end.
Yeah.
With the flash frame, whatever it was. But him, like, being stopped.
It was such a bad flash frame. I think... You know what? I think it was the girl who was gonna fuck wheelchair guy.
Yeah, that one. She's like cornered and her body's being dragged down the stairs afterwards.
Well, it was that, and then seeing Jason, like, jump out at her. I think that one, like, because I think I was, like, again, high and not, like, I think I had spaced out, and when I came back, he had jumped out, and I was just like, I gasped, and I think by definition, that one has to be my kill of the film, because that one scared me.
That one actually had an effect on
you. That one actually, like, I had an actual reaction to it. But yeah, I think that one's my kill of the film. What about you?
That, and then also crazy ass motherfucker getting garroted.
Yeah.
That was gruesome.
Garroted?
Garroted? Garroted. Garroted. Garroted.
It's a garrot.
Garroted. You know Garrett.
Garrett?
No, him getting garroted was actually... Oof, that was like a little... Of the scene that doesn't have that much graphic violence in the film.
Yeah.
They lingered enough where I was like, ew. Yeah. Actually, this was filled with some pretty good kills. They just don't get their chance to, like, be on screen too much longer.
Yeah, be, like, gross.
It is a little new. You're right. Now, I retract my previous one, actually. Let it show a little more gore.
Yeah.
You know? Let's find that cut.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
There's a fine line, I think, between, like, being gratuitously, like, gross and then, like, being, like...
Too coy.
Yeah, because, like, I keep saying it, but the double penetration.
The double penetration.
No, that scene, like, I was just like, I would have loved to have seen more gore from that scene, because you're literally, like, also, first of all, the amount of
You would
strength.
Love to see full penetration in the film. Gotcha. I got you.
I mean, we got quite a bit of penetration in the film, so the amount of, like strength it takes to take a fucking, like,
a spear
and putting it through two people, like, come on now. I need more.
Oh my god, if you just put it through one of them and she's just like, oh shit, I'm just grazed down here. Pretend to be. Oh, he's pushing it down. Fuck.
Yeah, well, yeah. And I was like, ugh. But yeah, so bad.
Okay, cool. Double penetration kill and lady trying to fuck wheelchair guy and crazy man getting garroted. Crazy Ralph.
Crazy Ralph.
Not a bad pool of kills. And that's not even, again, with the wheelchair guy and some of the other stuff.
And then Adrienne King's.
Oh, also, her getting the ice pick.
Yeah, hers was pretty good, too.
See, we're saying one kill the film, really, but we got a lot to pull from.
There are a lot of really great kills, so I respect it.
Yeah, a lot of good setups, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we had the first machete kill, too.
Oh, yeah.
Damn. All right, Friday the 13th Part 2. Surprisingly good sequel.
Yeah.
Okay, also, what happened to Paul?
He just vanished, huh?
Yeah, he just fucking vanished. They had no resolution. He got his ass kicked one time, just came back out of nowhere like Batman, gets his ass kicked another time, and then flash freeze, and then she's just off in an ambulance.
He is unconscious on the ground, left behind.
Yeah.
Because she ain't got time for that. That's what happened to Paul.
I think his body floated down, rolled down the hill into the river on a makeshift like raft that just happened to be from like a beaver dam. And he just floated down the river and lived a new life wherever he landed, somewhere.
What is this, Gulliver's Travels?
Maybe. But there's got to be a sequel with Paul, like, all bearded up as a lumberjack later on down the line.
I'm just like, okay. He wakes up, and then, like, because he got hit so hard, he doesn't remember who he is.
Yeah. He's just like, what's going on? He just has flashes at night sometimes with the fucking OG Jason. Just, oh my God.
He thinks he's Jason.
Baby, what's wrong? Oh, I'm sorry. I just, you know, I had that weird dream again.
He thinks he's Jason.
Oh my God, he comes back. It's Paul. There's two Jasons. There's one with the bag, the pillowcase over his head, and hockey mask, and they're both killing. They're like, okay, we know what that guy is. Fucking pillowcase is Paul. With his memory finally comes back. Oh, that's a good one.
It's a pretty good one.
Hey.
We're pretty good at this.
Yeah, we made that shit up on the fly right now. Yeah.
Love that for us.
Oh, dude, nice. Okay. Big question, Miss Favorite Slasher.
All right.
How does this film compare to the first one?
I like it just as much, if not a little bit more.
Right? Isn't it surprisingly fucking good?
Again, if the characters in the first one weren't such huge shitheads, mm-hmm. I probably would have been equal, but I mm-hmm. think just, I love the characters so yeah, much.
Same here.
In this one. Like, they're just enjoyable characters.
If the gore was a little better.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing. Like, that's what kind of levels it out. But yeah. I did enjoy this one just a touch more.
Just a touch more?
Yeah. So, final ranking out of 5 machetes.
Oh. 3.5 machetes.
I will also give it a 3.5
machetes. That's right.
3.5 machetes mm-hmm. out of 5 machetes.
Poor Steve Dash's finger. Okay.
All right. Let's go ahead and wrap this up.
Okay. So next week, guys, we're covering another type of sequel. Hint right here. Straight to video.
It is a straight to video sequel. It's a sequel from a film. We've covered the first one. I think that should be established, by the way.
These are all films we've covered. We've covered
the first one in all of these, so... Mm-hmm.
And this one was a surprising one. I didn't know... Well, I mean, I remember it coming out and thinking, like, aw, why not theaters?
Yeah.
Yeah. But I guess we'll find out.
We'll find out why.
We'll fucking find out. Okay, all cool. Right.
So, thank you so much, everyone, for joining us this week. Thank you so much for the warm return back to the podcast universe. We're happy to be back. And,
oh, my God. So happy, dude.
We're glad you enjoyed our first episode back. So please, if you like what you heard, please give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. We do this podcast completely for free. So that's the closest you can come to paying us for what we do.
Yes.
we accept payments in the form of 5-star ratings on iTunes.
And nice little written reviews that make us just make our day.
It's true. It makes our hearts sing. And then, let's see, if you want to follow up what we're doing on social media, totally do that, because Anthony runs the Instagram, I run the Twitter. Anthony is totally on it with all of the cool, hip and happening stuff on Instagram. And so please follow us on those things that I totally
platforms,
know.
Platforms.
it's my job.
Yeah, I know, right?
But please follow us on Instagram, and you can find us there at Horrible People's Podcast. That is HORROBLE People's Podcast. And then you could find us on Twitter at Horror People Pod. And then you can find Anthony on Twitter and Instagram at Hyrulean Hustler. And then you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Ghost Coffee Shop.
Bam.
Boom, baby.
We did it.
All right. So we will catch you guys next week. Have a fantastic rest of your week. And thank you so much for joining us.
Peace out, you fuckers.
Bye, guys.